Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. Today, I'm reading from the May and June editions of National Geographic Magazine. We begin with an article from the May edition, written by Adam Nicholson, titled, Water from the Chalk. Welling up through white, porous rock, England's chalk streams are prized by anglers and poets alike. Now supporters are wading in to help them thrive. Step into the water of an English chalk stream, 2 or 3 feet deep, shaded by willows and alders, and you feel the pressure and cold of it around your knees and thighs. The gravel underfoot is dappled with sunlight reaching down to the river floor. All around you, the motion of the water is sustained and untroubled, the current never urgent, because chalk streams are spring-fed and little silt finds its way into them. Visibility is aquarium clear. The trout within them seem to hang in the air. These streams take their quality from the rock over which they run. Alkaline, mineral-rich, with dissolved calcium carbonate, but almost no sediment, flowing to the sea over many miles of clean flint gravel bed, bubbling up from springs that emerge from deep aquifers in the chalk. They run through valleys fringed with watermint and clusters of water forget-me-nots, often thick with life-sheltering weeds. No subject to the surges of rivers that run over harder rocks, they flow steadily through the English chalk country, whose gentle landforms billow across the nation's southern and eastern reaches. Chalk is a pure type of limestone composed of tiny shells of marine organisms. Deposits are found worldwide, but in England, the geological ripples from the rising of the Alps some 40 million years ago brought a wide swath of it to the surface. It's porous and fractured, with up to 40% of its bulk made up of spaces between the rock grains. Rain that falls on chalk sinks into the ground, sometimes taking months to percolate through the hills. In that way, the rivers have a kind of steady maturity about them. Rainstorms produce no floods, and in drought, the rivers continue to run. The water acquires the temperature of the rock, 50 to 54 degrees Fahrenheit, all year. This means that the plants and animals that live in the chalk streams can depend on continuity. If you go snorkeling in a chalk stream, you'll find yourself in another world, so absorbing that nothing else encroaches, says Nicola Crawford, invertebrate river snorkeler and conservationist with the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. There are flowering water crowfoots whose white blossoms unfold first underwater, as well as patches of bright green starworts with trout and grayling loitering in their shadows. On the gravel bed, larval cases of caddisflies look like tiny sticks. Young trout, parr, tiger-striped and quivering, hold their own in some corner of the current, their bodies never still. Farther off in the green dark of the stream, larger fish melt carefully away. Anyone connected with these rivers talks about them with undisguised love. Zam Baring, who with his brother and sisters runs the Grange at Icton Stoke in Hampshire, one of England's leading sparkling wine vineyards, says his vines have their heads in the chalky Hampshire Downs and their toes in the sparkling headwaters of the River Icken. To go wading deep in the tributary that runs below the vineyard, he says, is to think you've gone to floaty heaven. A lifelong fisherman and co-vice chair of the Wessex Rivers Trust, Baring has helped lead numberless river restorations and celebrates even the smallest streams. You'll find all kinds of beauties in a quarter inch of water, he says. Russell Biggs, who champions the needs of chalk streams in the east of the country, says the tiny river Babbingley saved his life. His waste recycling business was struggling and driving him to despair. I would get home and, he pauses, but then to come here, walk by the river, I think if I was in a flat in the city center, I would just not be around. Put it that way, it gives you a reason. These are not the waterways of a remote wilderness. The fisherman, journalist, and author Charles Wrangley Wilson calls chalk streams the rivers of habitable country. It is beauty on your doorstep, he says, but because they are on your doorstep, they are also very threatened. Human damage began thousands of years ago and led to a crescendo of change and destruction in the mid-20th century. Cities and farms casually polluted them. Property owners dammed or widened them, slowing their current, ironing out their natural meanders, and removing fallen trees, which make life difficult for anglers, but good for fish and other river life. Slowing a river causes thick mats of silt to settle on the stream bed and blanket the gravel, whose clean, aerated spaces the trout and salmon need to lay their eggs. Beneficial weeds, nurseries for invertebrates, grow only in bright, fast water. Without the weeds, the all-important insect life, the many different species of mayflies, stoneflies, and caddisflies, collapses. Without the bug life, there is no fish life, no wild brown trout or grayling. Without the fish life, there is no otter life, and none of the magical, quick, quivering presence that gives the rivers their own life. Miles of the Icton and the famous River Test, which runs down through the Hampshire Chalk to its mouth near Southampton, have been turned into easy fishing parks with carefully mown banks, gingerbread fishing huts, and huge nursery-raised trout. Fees to fish the most celebrated stretches can run more than $600 a day. The fast bubbling water and the varied ecological niches of the natural stream have been erased. There is also, inevitably in a crowded country, the pervasive influence of pollution. Detergents, microplastics, pharmaceuticals, and heavy metals, as well as waste that's flushed down toilets, all arrive in the streams. Fisherman Paul Jennings has seen his local sewage works discharge waste into the River Chess, north of London, for more than 90 days, 68 days without a break. It was dreadful. You didn't want to go into it. A smell, a muddy color, nasty gray and horrible, with bits in it, he says. After rain, the first thing you see coming down the river is the diesel washed off the roads, says riverkeeper Peter Farrow, who works for a private estate that includes a stretch of the Test. Soil from careless plowing near the river chokes many of the clean gravels on which the fish rely. Overuse of phosphate and nitrate fertilizers in agriculture overstimulates the rivers, whose beds then clog with filamentous weeds, which smother invertebrate eggs, get in the gills of fish, and choke out the beneficial plants, the oxygenators, says freshwater ecologist Janina Gray, deputy CEO of the conservation group Wildfish. A political system that puts cheap tap water before river health has not helped. If anything is worse than a polluted chalk stream, it's a river that has been denied the water that is its very life, water that has been sucked from the underlying aquifers to service human needs. In some places, the water table has dropped more than 20 feet. If you have a river that's dry, there is no point in worrying about water quality and habitat because it's just not a river, says Rangley Wilson. Flow is fundamental. All across Chalk Country, river advocacy groups have emerged in the past few years. Forced to stay home during the pandemic lockdowns, many people discovered their local rivers, and public pressure for change has never been more intense. Over the past 20 years or so, advocacy groups, water companies, and government departments have written a series of large-scale, multi-decade plans for reservoirs, desalination plants, domestic water meters, and water transfer networks to reduce the amount of water taken from the chalk. Increasingly, rivers are having their natural form restored. Simon Kane began almost single-handedly to event chalk stream restoration in England, after being jolted into action one grievous summer afternoon in 1984, as he fished the River Ebble in Wiltshire, the water turned chocolate, he says. Upstream, he could see a large orange machine moving its digger arm in and out of the riverbed. The Ebble was being dredged with government funding to lower the water table in the surrounding meadows, perhaps to make them suitable for arable crops. In the detritus, Kane spotted hundreds of rare and endangered crayfish all grasping at the evening air. 40 years later, the same stretch of the Ebble remains a sad and withered thing. The three cardinal virtues of a healthy river are gradient, velocity, and sinuosity, says Kane, who founded a company specializing in river restoration. Over the past decades, his firm has reshaped numerous rivers into a healthier form, removing weirs and dams, roughening their flow, adding the twists and turns that create varied habitats for plants, invertebrates, and fish. Many river restorers have followed in Kane's path, among them Rangley Wilson, who has worked with Kane to reinvigorate a stretch of the North Nar in North Norfolk. For centuries, it had been trapped in a straight channel leading to a mill. With no gradient, no sinuosity, and no flow, the river had died a sluggish, silty death. But over the past few years, Rangley Wilson has been reconnecting the Nar to its valley, restoring its meanders, dragging in some trees to disrupt the flow and diversify the habitat, and allowing natural processes free rein. The cost of restoration can run about $130,000 per mile of river, usually funded by government grants and support from landowners. I went fishing with Rangley Wilson one afternoon, and as we came to a new bit of channel less than 2 years old, the river ran and chuckled loosely beside us. Within 30 seconds, Rangley Wilson had hooked a wild trout, and then another, and another. All were small, only a half pound or so, but then he spotted something more. Ooh, there's a nice trout. He's going to hide under the bank there. He landed his fly, the rod bent, and he brought the trout into the gravel shallows. The river he had made was full of life. Slipping the barbless fly from the trout's jaw, he held it on the surface of the stream, allowing the water to lap over the red and black sprinkles of its body. Then he let it go away, an emblem of the beauty of these streams that will all, we hope, one day be restored to life. And that concludes the article titled Water from the Chalk, written by Adam Nicholson. Stream Sampler. Although most stretches of chalk streams are privately owned, glimpses of their beauty can be enjoyed on long-distance footpaths and at bridge crossings, or for a fee with a fishing charter. Best Walks. In Hampshire County, the Test Way begins at Inkpen and ends 44 miles later at Elling. The 32-mile Icton Way traces its namesake from source to mouth, starting at Hinton Amper and concluding at Scholing Station. To see a stretch of restored chalk stream, take a stroll along the Nar Valley Way from the pretty Norfolk County village of Castle Acre, where you'll find pubs, picnic areas, and restrooms. Quick Looks. For a snapshot of a classic chalk stream, stand on the bridge over the River Avon at Braymore in Hampshire, where the view includes trout-filled water and an ancient mill. Or try the footbridge over the River Test at Whitchurch in Shropshire. Local children have, for years, thrown bread into the water below the bridge, resulting in some of the fattest trout you'll ever see. Fishing. Day tickets to fish stretches of more than a dozen chalk streams are available at fishingbreaks.co.uk and other companies. Prices range from $100 to $600. Try Combe Mill on the Avon, $200 to $300, where riverkeeper Martin Aris will introduce you to the mysteries and alluring habits of wild trout. Eat, Sleep, Fish. The Bush Inn Pub at Ovington is an ideal place to start or finish a hike along the Icton with a hearty meal. Grosvenor Hotel at Stockbridge on the Test is one of the upscale temples of dry fly fishing and offers comfortable accommodations. Our next article is from the June edition of the magazine, written by Brian Scarry, titled Degrees of Change. National Geographic photographer Brian Scarry has been diving in the Gulf of Maine for more than 40 years. After learning that these waters were warming faster than almost any part of the ocean, he set out to document the rapid shift and its astonishing ripple effects. The bounty of the Gulf of Maine, the sea within a sea, it's often called, is a body of water that extends 36,000 square miles along the eastern seaboard of North America from Cape Cod, Massachusetts to New Brunswick, and encompasses the coastlines of New Hampshire, Maine, and Nova Scotia. Indigenous Americans who have lived in this region for more than 12,000 years learned the Gulf's natural rhythms and sustainably harvested its rich waters. Europeans who began to settle in the area in the 15th century recorded tales of an endless abundance with cod that measured up to 5 feet long. Before the American Revolution began, giant lobsters and thick schools of fish would have had a front row seat to the Boston Tea Party. I think of the Gulf of Maine as having been created from a perfect recipe that required a precise series of ingredients and steps. There is a robust watershed with many rivers flowing into the sea, and a unique blend of currents that brings and mix nutrients, including upwelling from the continental shelf, the Gulf Stream, the Labrador, and counterclockwise coastal currents. Because of the Gulf of Maine's geographic location in a temperate zone, a seasonal stratification that separates water into warmer and cooler layers also occurs here. The result has historically been the proliferation of life. But things have changed. Over the centuries, the rise of sophisticated commercial fishing fleets has led to a steep decline in marine wildlife. Atlantic cod, its supply once believed to be inexhaustible, is now at 1% of colonial levels. So within just a couple hundred years, we have removed 99% of this species from the region. In the past 4 decades spent exploring these waters, I have witnessed how such declines have made the ecosystem weaker and more vulnerable in ways I never imagined. I grew up in a working-class town in Massachusetts, about 40 miles from the ocean, but my parents would take me to the beach in summertime. As early as I can remember, I fell in love with the sea. My dream was to be an ocean explorer and photographer, sharing all that I saw and learned. In my 26 years of capturing images for National Geographic, I've been fortunate to work on all 7 continents and in nearly every marine ecosystem, from the equator to the poles. I have always felt, however, that the ocean suffers from a bit of a curse and that its exterior hides what lies beneath. Both the exquisite natural beauty and the ongoing devastation. That's why the most crucial part of my job doesn't really happen in the water. Before each expedition, I first dive as deeply as possible into the world of researchers who dedicate their lives to understanding marine animals and their relationship to the environment. Only then can I bring the right visual context. Whether they're images of orcas using different feeding strategies in order to share the rich complexity of the whale culture, or photos of a 5-day-old harp seal pup falling through thin ice to show how deadly our warming planet has become for some species. My goal is to help people understand what's happening in our world. Years ago, I moved to the coast of Maine to more frequently explore these waters. In doing so, I saw signs of a looming threat. People in marine science and conservation communities had grown alarmed after reading a 2015 paper by Andrew Pershing, then chief scientific officer at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Within a few years, it had become common knowledge among locals that the Gulf of Maine was warming faster than 99% of the world's oceans. I now felt an urgency to share the wonder of my native waters, to focus on the beautiful wildlife that remains while highlighting the effects of climate change. To get it right, to make sure my images were representative of that change and its enormous impact on the region, I contacted many scientists and experts who have spent decades studying the Gulf. My original plan was to visit the most spectacular locations I had dived in decades past, places like Eastport, Maine, where the extreme tides of Pamiskwati Bay exchange water and nutrients multiple times a day. I remembered Eastport as a cold water kaleidoscope of fish species and invertebrates that could be easily seen just by making a dive from the beach. But when I got there, it was like a ghost town. The abundance of life that I had seen before was gone. Where exotic-looking creatures once carpeted the bottom, now there was only mud. Water temperatures were noticeably warmer. The singular mix of elements that made the Gulf of Maine a fertile oasis is the reason it is now warming faster than almost anywhere else. These waters are also a harbinger for what the rest of the world might see. According to Charles Tilburg, an oceanographer and the director of marine and environmental programs at the University of New England, the Gulf works like a bathtub. If you turn down the cold water and turn up the hot water, the bathtub's going to get warmer. Tilburg has spent about 15 years tracking how the frigid Labrador Current is weakening, providing less cold water to the Gulf, while the hotter Gulf Stream is shifting slightly north and adding warmer water to the region. But despite the collective stresses of overfishing and climate change, there are some species that have benefited, if only temporarily. So far, temperatures in the Gulf of Maine have stayed suitable for lobster reproduction. The lobster fishing industry appears to be flourishing. But scientists have identified some troubling changes. When temperatures rise to more than 73 degrees Fahrenheit near the coast, female lobsters stay farther offshore, where offspring they release might not intersect with currents that can carry them to the food sources and habitats that are more conducive to survival. These so-called larval lobsters eat zooplankton. Their preferred prey is Calanus, a 2 to 3 millimeter copepod that is made up mostly of fat to sustain them through the winter. David Fields, a professor of oceanography at Bigelow Laboratory for Ocean Sciences, calls it the French butter of copepods, good for bulking up little lobsters. As the water warms, Calanus copepods no longer need as much fat and grow smaller. That means the baby lobsters lose out on nutrition. Additionally, the warming water has shifted the Calanus's migration period, which is putting it out of sync with the release of larval lobsters. So even though female lobsters are producing the same number of eggs as before, fewer are surviving into adulthood. In 2023, Maine saw the lowest lobster haul in 15 years, mimicking what's been happening off the coast of New York, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. There's more bad news for lobsters. The same carbon emissions behind climate change affects not only the ocean's temperature, but also its chemistry. The water is becoming more acidic. Fields says anything with a calcium exoskeleton or chitinous shell, from coral reefs to copepods, can get eroded by such acidification. It could potentially threaten a young lobster's fragile exoskeleton in 10 or 20 years. Other disturbing trends have surfaced. Wen Watson, a marine biologist and emeritus professor at the University of New Hampshire, has studied the changing pH that may endanger lobsters' ability to smell. That can make it harder for them to find food, detect predators, or sense each other's pheromones during mating season, which has already gotten more difficult because female lobsters prefer colder temperatures, while males are fine in warmer water. Mates are literally drifting apart. On this ocean planet, what happens underwater clearly has consequences on land. For example, the changes occurring with fish populations in the Gulf of Maine are having a direct impact on seabirds. Tern parents see silverfish reflecting sunlight in the ocean and bring them back to their chicks. When parents hunt their typical prey, such as hake or herring, the hatchlings can swallow these slender silverfish easily. But as the water warms, terns can choose their prey from a larger range of silverfish, such as the wide-bodied butterfish, which have shifted north from the mid-Atlantic. Though some adult birds still find appropriate prey, To many, a silverfish may simply be a silverfish. Elizabeth Craig, director of seabird research at the Shoals Marine Laboratory, which is largely funded by the New Hampshire Fish and Game Department, has found that the chicks are unable to swallow the butterfish. They're not getting enough food, and many remain smaller and either die before they leave the nest or are too weak to migrate. It's a poignant reinforcement of what we already know. Ocean ecosystems are in decline. I'm seeing dramatic ecological changes that should take millions of years, and yet they're happening in my lifetime. But there are success stories. Plenty of evidence shows that when we permanently protect places in the ocean, remove obstacles, and give marine life a chance, nature finds a way. It is resilient, and it can heal. But nature needs a little help. The alewife is one story of hope in the Gulf of Maine. This species of fish is an important source of protein for many animals as it migrates from the freshwater ponds where it spawns to the ocean and then back again. In the oceans and in estuaries, where rivers flow into the sea, alewives are eaten by other fish and by birds, such as eagles, ospreys, and cormorants. As they migrate into streams in the forest, they can become food for animals such as raccoons and foxes. Finally arriving at their spawning ponds, they must avoid predators like freshwater bass. Survivors of this gauntlet go back to the ocean with their fry following a few months later. Alewives had virtually disappeared from the Gulf because dams kept them from migrating. The removal of dams in key rivers, such as the Penobscot and Presumpscot, done largely in hopes of restoring Atlantic salmon populations, resulted in the revival of the alewife's ancient migratory route. Runs of fish in the millions now occur every spring. One beautiful experience I've had in recent years was photographing alewives at the base of a waterfall in Millbrook Preserve, a tributary of the Presumpscot. The fish gather there to rest before going up the falls. Lying with my camera in only 2 feet of water, I was surrounded by thousands of alewives swirling around me the way I imagined the river would have been long ago. Perhaps the most special place I have explored in this region is Cache's Ledge, a unique underwater mountain range in the middle of the Gulf of Maine. John Whitman, a marine biologist at Brown University, calls it a time machine to when the Gulf was packed with marine life. As Whitman has documented, Cache's has one of every kind of offshore or subtidal marine habitat that exists off the coast of New England, with species rarely seen elsewhere. Because of the ledge's submerged rocky ridges, waves and currents push large amounts of plankton to the creatures that eat it. Whitman says it's like a food elevator. In order for climate stability to even be possible, researchers say, we need to protect a minimum of 30% of key habitats in the ocean. Today, only about 8% are formally protected. For Whitman, who has been studying Cache's since the 1970s, designating the area as a marine sanctuary feels more urgent than ever. By protecting it, we would help ensure healthy fishery stocks in the future. The fish biomass in Cache's is 300 times that on the coast. Animals that live there obviously don't just stay in one place, so they propagate and spill over. Cache's also contains the largest kelp forest off the coast of the eastern United States. That's important because kelp serves as both the base of the food chain and a distinct ecosystem. As a diver, I've marveled at the vastness of this amber and crimson colored forest swaying so far beneath the surface. For his part, Whitman compares the underwater journey to Cache's to a drive through the plains of Iowa for hundreds of miles and coming across a huge mountain with a forest. And like the woods on land, kelp forest captures carbon. We've come to the end of our time today on the Magazine Rack. Next time, I will continue reading the article, Degrees of Change, written by Brian Scarry. I've been reading from the May and June editions of National Geographic Magazine. I'm Jennifer Ackerman. So long till next time.